Thanks for tuning in this evening. You're listening to the Thursday Night Special, and tonight we have part two of our program on teen suicide and epidemic in our community. And I'd like you to go ahead and introduce our guests, their different voices from last week, and explain a little bit about the program.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, LaDonna. We are so excited to be here for night two of a two-part special in regards to suicide, especially amongst our young population, and the prevention of. And I hope you hear some of the same things you heard from this panel tonight that you did from our panel last night. We are all from Johnson County Mental Health Center. I'm your host again, Renee Van Meter, and I am proud to have three of my esteemed colleagues here with me. They are new colleagues than last week. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to ask them each to introduce themselves, what their role at the Mental Health Center is, and we'll also ask them to tell us just a little bit about of how their role intersects with this topic itself.
Thanks, Renee. My name is Rob McDougall, and I'm the Director of Emergency Services at Johnson County Mental Health Center. And in terms of my role in intersection with suicide, particularly youth suicide, I've got four different teams that work closely in our community in trying to prevent and intervene with suicide. And this would include our after-hours program, which is our evening crisis services that answers our crisis line and is involved in some community-based interventions. Our daytime crisis team, our mobile crisis response team, which also answers our crisis line and frequently takes calls related to suicide and suicide intervention. Our mental health co-responder program. We have a crisis recovery center, a 10-bed respite facility for adults. And then lastly, our open access team, which is the front door to our mental health center.
Good evening. This is Susan Rome. I'm the deputy director at the Mental Health Center. I think several things in terms of my role as the deputy director. I think that one of the key pieces that I do is to try to pay attention to what's happening in our community, that we're meeting the needs of our community to the best of our abilities, paying attention to the quality of our services, some of the things that might be problem areas or gaps in services, the processes in which we look at as we're trying to bring people in, and some of that internal pieces. So just trying to keep a pulse on what's happening around internally and externally, and just trying to provide some guidance and leadership in those areas as we support those various different divisions that do that work.
Great. Hi, and I'm Shanna Burgess. I'm the Director of Prevention and Community Relations. I'm also on the leadership team for the Johnson County Suicide Prevention Coalition. So my work with that coalition and my work in prevention is a lot of education and outreach, as well as community mobilization. So again, working, for example, with the coalition to bring people together to talk about this subject and kind of think about what's going on in our community, what are we concerned about, what are some of the gaps in our community, and then how do we solve that together? So that would be my role in suicide prevention.
I appreciate that. I appreciate hearing from all of you. And I truly am excited to be able to host this night again. I get to talk with these amazing people a lot in my job, and so I'm just so excited to share this with our community and with those listening and who have listened. We have got some amazing feedback from people who tuned in last week, and that just melts my heart. It's so awesome to get this message out there. So we had some pretty dynamic folks here last week. I think you'll be impressed this week as well. Just to kind of catch us up to date. Last week we talked about some pretty powerful statistics. We talked about some trends. We talked about some populations that teen suicide impacted more than others. We talked about some risk factors. We also, I hope, put out there who's helping and how can you help. So one thing that I have come across since our time last week is another pretty staggering fact. So on average, one person dies by suicide approximately every 18 hours in the state of Kansas. The three people in front of me might not have known that I was going to kick us off with a pretty alarming statement, but I am. This is what we're here to talk about tonight. So, again, I'm going to say that again. One person dies by suicide approximately every 18 hours in the state of Kansas. Additionally, suicide is the second leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 34. I want to know, where do we start? How do we address this?
Such a big question, and I guess I'll be the first one to jump in here. So I think thinking about prevention is such a big word. So prevention for an individual might be one thing. Prevention in the scope of a community, what do we do together or as a school district or as law enforcement? You know, we all need to think about prevention and our role in that. So one of the most basic terms thinking about prevention is just referring to risk and protective factors. So risk factors are simply characteristics that make it more likely that an individual may consider, attempt, or die by suicide. And protective factors are really those characteristics that make it less likely that an individual may consider, attempt, or die by suicide. So as we think about a suicide-safer community, we need to find ways to decrease the risk and increase protection. And also think about what everyone's role in is that. So as a hospital, as a business, as a police officer, as a teacher, as a mental health professional, what's my role? So thinking about what we do, it's really everyone in the community, and suicide prevention is everyone's business and everyone's responsibility.
So when I think of both risk and protective factors, particularly with youth, and just starting with some of those risk factors, what comes to mind most predominantly are things like, you know, having a significant mental health issue, maybe a particular family crisis or situation that's happening. Some of the things that might even be contributing could be some poverty issues, some difficulties at school. Bullying is something we hear a lot about. That can be bullying at school or social media or all kinds of things that are happening there. Could be substance use that's happening, you know, with a young person. That's definitely a factor in what's going on with them. So there's a variety of things that can be contributing risk factors, and I think it's important for us to delve into those a little bit more. When I think of protective factors, again, what Shanna was saying, we're trying to think of what are some things that we can put in place to sort of build that resiliency or build that capacity for our youth and adults, but for our youth specifically today, to have that kind of ability to bounce back, so to speak, because we're all going to have things that happen. Our youth are all going to have difficult times in their lives, difficult situations, maybe even periods of time, can be years or chronic issues. That could be anything from an illness to a family issue. So when we think about protective factors, we want to focus on the things that help them be resilient. So that's teaching coping skills. And that might sound really, really basic, but even I, as a parent in the mental health world, don't always think a lot about, you know, what am I teaching my kids about how they can manage when something doesn't go their way. You know, when I don't make a basket at the end of the basketball game, or maybe I don't get a good grade on a test I've tried really hard on, or I have a difficulty in my schoolwork, or there's a particular teacher I'm struggling with, a friend, or maybe it's in my own family. Maybe there's a sibling or another family member that I'm struggling with. Maybe my parents are going through divorce. So those coping skills are really important. So beyond the skills, there's some really basic things that we can think about in just forming in our youth good habits. So things like good eating habits, good sleeping habits, you know, how much time we're spending on screen time we talk about, whether that's social media or TV or the Xbox or those kind of things, making sure we're trying to balance out those connections with something that's on a computer or other screen versus human contact, because that human contact is super important. Those connections with people, whether that's, again, a family member, someone supportive, a coach, a healthcare provider, any of those kind of folks in that young person's life that can be a positive influence. So when they have someone they can connect to when they are struggling, or when they're not struggling, but certainly when they are struggling, they've got that meaningful connection that they can go to and turn to that can be really useful for them.
I think it's really interesting how you wove together two really different things really well, so much so that I was going back and forth between, okay, she's talking about risk factors. Okay, wait a minute. Now she's partnering that with protective factors. And I think that's just a really neat concept to point out. We have to think of these things together. We've got to start thinking together about what puts our youth at risk. But man, what builds them up? What protects them? So I appreciate the way that you talked about that. I saw it, maybe it's kind of two compartmentalized topics or subject matter, but really appreciated how you wove those together. I think it's important to talk about risk because suicide is a result of a risk-taking behavior. And I just really want to throw it to Rob, just kind of in the emergency services lens. Are there any other risk factors, particularly in youth, that you'd just want to add to the conversation?
Sure. And, you know, Susan started to hit on some of the risk factors. And just to reiterate, certainly any sort of history of diagnosed mental health or mental health treatment, substance abuse, if a kiddo is displaying signs of or expressing hopelessness, impulsive and aggressive tendencies, especially sudden changes in those behaviors, history of trauma, that definitely is a contributor to increasing risk for potential suicide. Any sort of history of previous attempts. A big factor that we're frequently asking as we were assessing is if there's any history within the family. And with that too, if that person or that kiddo has had somebody close to them that they've lost, even outside of the family, a friend or a peer. Loss of close, meaningful relationships, you know, recent deaths of grandparents or siblings or parents, their access to lethal means, particularly guns. Those would be a variety of risk factors that we would be looking at when assessing and trying to prevent suicide.
I appreciate that. No, thanks for expanding on the list. Anybody else want to keep adding to that or anything else to say about those risk factors?
You know, Rob said it, but I think just reiterating of trust, you know, when those shifts happen. So it might be something in a youth that you notice, whether your son or daughter or someone that you know or love, and seeing those shifts, seeing those differences of they used to be like this and that now it's like this is really important to trust your gut. So if you have that sense or you have that feeling that something wrong or different, being ready and willing to offer that support and reach out is super important.
And I just want to add, I think any of us who are our parents and or aunts, uncles, so forth, we know that kids don't always tell us what's happening in their lives, right? So asking those questions are really important, and we'll talk about that more. But it really struck me what Shannon was saying is when you start to see that shift, you might be asking your teen or kid, what's going on? I know even for myself, my kids are kind of preteen, early teen. Is it just part of being that age? Is it moodiness? Is it what, you know, I don't always know, and I'm a mental health professional, right? So just trying to figure that out, but also making sure that maybe you're not the only one that can ask the question. Maybe it's dad, or maybe it's mom, or maybe it's aunt or uncle or friend's parent. If you don't feel like you're able to figure out to some degree if there's that big shift or small shift even, what's really happening, trying to expand that circle of folks that might be able to connect a little bit better, asking those questions to teachers, coaches, other people in their lives.
I appreciate that. And that really, really ties together a lot of the stuff that we talked about last Thursday in bringing really to the surface of this conversation. Hey, parents, it's not always you that your kids are going to reach out to. And so when Shannon was so nicely saying, just reminding us that if you notice a difference, the you can be a friend, an aunt, an uncle, a teacher, any adult, any close person in that child's life can notice that difference and really make a change. I think Susan led us into a question that I need to ask is, how do we know? We say, see a difference. What are some of those warning signs that, that we can look for?
Yes, Renee, and to give you some specific behaviors that, that you may notice that, that hopefully can trigger potentially intervening and asking some of those tough questions. You know, very clearly, if a kiddo is talking overtly about wanting to die or wanting to kill themselves, if you find out somewhere or the other that they're the kiddo is looking up, whether it's on the internet or some other way, on ways to hurt themselves or kill themselves. If they're expressing hopelessness or that they're experiencing, you know, unbearable emotional pain, expressing that they're feeling like a burden to others, those are all very, very strong signs of depression and can oftentimes be a sign of being suicidal. There's a lot of shame and stigma that comes with talking about symptoms of depression, talking about mental illness, and oftentimes somebody, when they're having those overwhelming emotions, feels a sense of being trapped. And as we'll talk about a little bit more, having somebody ask that question of how they're doing, if they're feeling safe, if they're feeling suicidal, can oftentimes bring a sense of relief. If you notice an increase in use of drugs or alcohol, as we talked about earlier, too, a sudden change in behavior and seeing stronger emotions, level of agitation or anxiety, too much sleep or too little sleep, so we're really looking for those extremes. All of a sudden, the kiddo is less interested in things that they found a lot of enjoyment and pleasure out of in the past. And then lastly, I think sometimes an overlooked a warning sign within the school system is if all of a sudden the kiddo seems to be functioning well and shows up at school on a regular basis, but then is absent for a period of time or a long period of time. This can be signs that we need to maybe ask some questions.
I appreciate. So we put risks, we put warning out there, right? Rob, you just said before we intervene, what does that look like? Let's just. Yeah, get some examples of what are these interventions, what are these strategies that you guys are talking about?
Well, I think the most important strategy in my mind is just asking the question. Are you feeling like committing suicide, dying by suicide? Are you feeling like you want to hurt yourself, you want to kill yourself? Being very direct, there's this sort of myth out there that if you bring it up, you're going to sort of insert that idea with someone, and that's very much a myth. So asking the direct question is really important. You may give that person this immediate sense of relief that they can speak about it or that someone's noticed that they're doing, and maybe that just gives them that permission at that moment, hopefully, to speak up and say, yes, I am, and hopefully then, you know, I need help. But again, just I can't emphasize enough just asking the question, being direct. It can be really uncomfortable to ask that question, and sure, it can be. And so what I would say is do it anyway. If it makes you uncomfortable, yeah, things sometimes do.
I can't help but right bring our listeners to that point is that that's uncomfortable. I know that we can sit around and talk about this. We talk about it with ease. I hope that you guys have noticed in these past two segments. This is what we do. How do you make this easier?
Yeah, easy it is not. There's no doubt about that. I think a lot of times people will perceive it as anticipating a confrontation. Mm-hmm. And I would probably ask for us to maybe reframe that conversation. There's a gentleman by the name of David Augsburger who sort of coined a phrase or an idea of carefronting instead of confronting. And I think if we can start those conversations with expressing to the person how much that you care about them, how much you love them, and this is why I'm wanting to ask some difficult questions or enter into that conversation. And one other thing in terms of talking about myths, oftentimes there's a perception that if somebody talks about being suicidal, that they're just wanting or just looking for attention. Statistically, the reality is 70% of those who threaten or talk about suicide end up attempting or committing suicide. So if somebody is talking about it, that's a strong sign that we need to act and take some action.
I'm just going to jump in here of strategies is really one thing is simply reducing access to lethal means. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I want to talk about is being involved with the coalition, the Johnson County Suicide Prevention Coalition, teamed up with Project Child Safe and local law enforcement to be able to distribute gun locks. So it's about if you are owning a gun and have a gun in your home to be able to lock that up. That might be to reduce the risk of someone who's entering your home, or even if you're the gun owner and having thoughts of suicide, even that second, that minute that it takes to find the key to unlock that could really be a turning point in thinking about that. So I think access to means is definitely something that we need to think about, not only firearms, but thinking about in my world of prevention and thinking about substance abuse prevention as well. So many of us have just a medicine cabinet full of prescription medications. So not only for substance use prevention, but suicide prevention as well. You know, when you get that 30-day supply of something and use two pills, well, you know, some of us might think, oh, I'm going to save that for next time. But that is really a risk, whether it's people who live in your home or guests or family members that are coming in your home. So I would really encourage everyone, and this is even for those of us who know about it and think about it, to take a look at what's in your medicine cabinet, lock it up, or get rid of it. So on a routine basis, they have drug take back days in our community. Not that anyone would need to wait for a drug take back day to destroy or get rid of that medication, but that is more of an awareness activity. So we have those coming up in our community, and really think about that and kind of scan what's in your home that could lead to increased risk with just access to it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to maybe bring it back a little bit to something that I can connect in my own profession here. Again, we talk about risk. We talk about warning signs. Susan, you mentioned coping skills earlier. Shanna just mentioned reducing access. And I love to use maybe the definition of coping skill is one more step between you and something unsafe. And so truthfully, as a mental health clinician in my role, I truly love it when people say to me, my coping skills aren't working. And I go, awesome. I want you to keep trying. I want you to do something else and something new and do it again until it works. Because, right, that's just one extra step. Every time you try a new coping skill, try the coping skill that's not working again. And so I just think, again, putting... I like when I don't have to take a lot of steps to do something. So why would that not apply to my impulsive, emotional thinking brain too? So I just appreciate you guys put that out there. Again, uncomfortable conversation for those of you who have not engaged in this. Is there a way, besides going and getting an education and wanting to live in this field, that our community members can intersect with practicing this dialogue or being exposed to this dialogue?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in just all honesty and transparency, having this conversation can be super paralyzing. Like, what do I do? What do I say? Am I going to say the wrong thing? And, you know, just encouraging that it's not about saying the right or wrong thing. It's about saying something, or maybe not saying anything, just listening and showing that you care. But a couple things that we offer at the Mental Health Center, and really probably many organizations or community mental health centers also offer, are two different courses that anyone in the community could take to become a little more familiarized with different mental health diagnoses, or also more comfortable and confident in supporting someone who might have struggles or really, you know, to the point of thinking about suicide. So one of those is mental health first aid, and I'm going to let Susan talk about that because she was actually a mental health first aid facilitator.
Yeah, so mental health first aid, I just think it's such a wonderful class and a wonderful opportunity for folks. And mental health first aid is really kind of the idea of, you think about CPR or first aid classes that you might take, and this is essentially the same thing. So you're learning about mental health, very basic techniques. How do you intervene? How do you have that awareness so you know if not someone's having a heart attack, but someone's having a mental health crisis or just situation that you can provide some support around? So mental health first aid is a one-day class. It's fairly basic in the sense that, you know, you're not covering every single diagnosis by any means. You're kind of getting a pretty good overview, and you walk away with knowing, okay, here's what I do if I come across the situation, and here's how I know if this is happening potentially around me. You know, maybe I have a coworker who's really struggling and I just haven't picked up on it. And then after I go to this class, I might go, oh, gosh, I missed this. And now I feel comfortable enough to just ask them a question about how they're doing or how I can help, or here's what I've noticed. So it's just really a helpful basic class that we can provide.
And then assist, I think of as the next level, and solely for suicide prevention. So assist is a two-day suicide-specific workshop that teaches people to recognize when someone might be at risk of suicide and then to work with them to support their immediate safety. And I think that's important to think about. And again, going back to that paralyzing thing, well, what is my role? What do I need to do? How long do I need to follow this out? And it's linking to that next step. It's listening. It's being there. It's showing that you care. And then what is that next step? What's that next level? Who is that person that I can connect them to? You know, one thing about assist that I think is so interesting is their, you know, the audience of who takes this two-day class. It might be a faith leader. It might be someone in law enforcement. Could be someone who has worked in crisis at the mental health center for 15 years, and they are still gaining value not only from what the course teaches, but also from the people in the room from multiple disciplines. So as I'm talking to the person from the school or law enforcement and going through strategies of what is our role and how do we work together to support individuals in our community. And then the other thing is just practicing. Going back to that, it's paralyzing. So if I don't practice when I'm not in the moment of asking that direct question, are you thinking about suicide? You know, are you thinking of that, or have you had thoughts of that, or where are you at? And again, without that practice with someone who's maybe more comfortable, it's hard. But again, it's not about saying the right thing. It's about reaching out, listening, and showing your support.
Okay, we are going to take a short break and have a couple of messages, and we will be back with more of our program on teen suicide. You're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm LaDonna Sanders. Stay tuned for more.
All right, welcome back. Thanks for letting us take a little breather in the midst of our really heavy topic. I'm going to get us right back into the conversation, but two things, again, that I really, really appreciate being reiterated in last week's segment and this week's, two items. One, the language we use is really important, and two, direct. The language we use should be direct. So I'm going to ask for education on what is the right thing to say, or what things should we not say or say less of?
I think the one thing that I would add to the what or how things that we should say would be to try to come from an empathic and validating perspective. I mean, we all have emotions, and I would like to think we would all agree that emotions are not judged to be right or wrong. They just are. So coming in with somebody who is having a strong emotions and attending to those first and expressing that you hear that they're sad, they're depressed, that they're angry, can be a very quick way to start the conversation and help a person feel comfortable enough to talk with you. There's definitely some things that I would encourage folks not to say. For one, making a statement, you have so much to live for. I think that person has probably already asked themselves a million times, why am I feeling this way when everybody else tells me that my life is great? Another comment sometimes, your suicide will hurt you or your family. And again, that's probably part of the washing machine cycle of thoughts that person has already had about that's tormenting them with that internal struggle of depression and suicide. Look on the bright side. Clearly, if it was as simple as just looking on the bright side, then they probably would not be struggling with that deep depression or those thoughts of suicide. When we enter these conversations, how we react can have a significant impact, especially with children. So wanting to try to do the best that we can to not act shocked by the information. That can be tough, for sure, but do the best that we can to control our own emotions. It's really probably not the best time to start lecturing the kiddo on the value of life and judgments such as suicide is wrong and that sort of thing. It's much more important to tend to the emotions and be working towards ensuring this person's safety. And then do not promise confidentiality. I mean, suicide is life or death. So if you have a kiddo that is talking about and expressing that they're thinking about suicide, we need to think about that as a life and death situation and don't make promises that we can't necessarily keep. I mean, if we're concerned about the life of this person, we may have to call 911. We may have to call a crisis line and pull somebody else in.
So 911, maybe if somebody could speak to that, or is there a time when there just aren't maybe words aren't the answer, or we've tried the words and that doesn't help? Where does 911 come into this equation?
Yeah, I from my perspective, the time to call 911 is when you feel like the person cannot be safe. You have that bad gut feeling, and it appears that this person's safety is at imminent risk. I would emphasize trusting that gut and that experience based on your relationship with that person. If you are concerned about that person's safety, please do not hesitate to call 911. And I've worked in emergency mental health services in Johnson County for 17 years, and a big part of my role, my job, has either been involved with answering the crisis line, going out in the community, and working with our local law enforcement partners in interviewing and intervening, and participating in welfare checks, and then also managing our crisis line. And I can say that we've been involved with thousands in that time period of welfare checks and phone calls with law enforcement, and I can say confidently that our law enforcement community, their desire is to be there to help and to save lives. With that, it'd be good for me to talk a little bit about some of the training that we have for law enforcement. Currently, we have a CIT council, which consists of our local representation from five of our local law enforcement agencies, and that rotates over time. Our district attorney's office, some community members, and members of the Johnson County Mental Health. We facilitate relationship building surrounding all things related to mental health, but also two trainings a year locally and two trainings a year outside of our community, 40-hour week trainings for law enforcement surrounding mental health education and intervention. We also, as a council working with our local law enforcement and Johnson County Mental Health, we also have been facilitating mental health first aid trainings at both the academy and with our local PDs.
I'm going to pop in and play the Renee role here and ask a question.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yes, yes. Rob, you said CIT, but what does CIT stand for? You just rolled right in with that, and some of us might not know what that means.
Thank you, Shanna, for that cue.
Absolutely.
Crisis Intervention Team.
Thank you.
So thanks for that clarification, Shanna. And I want to clarify on that, too, that most all of our law enforcement agencies have CIT-trained officers. They vary in percentages. just because there are CIT officers at the agency does not mean CIT officers are always available. However, I would recommend that if you're having to call 911, if you're having to call law enforcement, to be sure to at least request a CIT officer with the understanding that they may not be available all the time.
I appreciate that. And Shanna, while I might have had held a little grudge for no, for the past 8 to 10 years, I thought it was crisis intervention training.
So does the rest of the world.
It is team. The T is team. I guess I can
way,
still learn some new
thing.
Tricks. That no, I really want my note that I just wrote down is that is powerful. To just for even for myself, again, a clinician in mental health emergency services, to hear there are folks in our community at the first responder, at the law enforcement level, getting additional training in regards to intervening in a mental health crisis. I know they see a lot of crises, but knowing that mental health crises are one of those, I just think it's really, really powerful, and it really speaks to what we talked about again last week, and I'm sure we'll get to tonight, is this takes a community. This is not, you're in it alone. And so are there any other big community projects or investments that we can talk about kind of in this segment of our program?
You know, I think one of the things that comes to mind as we're talking is just how fortunate we are in our community that we have these wonderful partnerships. So we have these longstanding connections with law enforcement, with our local emergency rooms and hospitals. We connect with other mental health providers. I mean, we're certainly not the only game in town, and that's great because there's plenty to go around. We have other partners in our community that are just as passionate as those of us sitting here today that want to help our youth and others. And then there's also other things that you might not expect in terms of partnerships and people really paying attention to this issue, like a primary care physician, for example. You know, one of the things I happened to notice in taking my kid to get a physical just at the end of last year is that they were doing a screening, and this was the first time I'd seen this in my particular pediatrician's office, but doing a screening around depression, and which I thought was wonderful, and I think we're seeing that and hearing more primary care and other healthcare providers paying attention to that particular issue and doing some of those things that are really key.
You know, one thing I just want to bump back to the calling 911, because my whole life I've been coached, don't call 911. Don't, you know, it has to be an emergency. What is an emergency? Well, if your house is on fire, if someone's breaking in or whatnot. So we don't often think about calling 911 in terms of behavioral health. So I want to put that out there and have people think about that. So it's not just if your house is on fire or if someone's breaking in, but if you have concern, just like Rob said earlier, if you have so much concern for someone of them not being able to keep themselves safe or others, definitely make that phone call.
And I'll follow that up with there are going to be times when you don't need to call 911 in that it's not imminent, and there are some other resources out there. So it would be good, I think, to mention those too.
Yeah.
First, Johnson County Mental Health has a 24/7 crisis line where we have trained mental health professionals that are answering it, and they are there to help intervene with individuals that are struggling with mental health issues. And anybody can call, whether it's a person specifically themselves, a family member, landlords. So we get a lot of calls, in particular from law enforcement, that we're helping to triage and problem solve with law enforcement. And that number is 913-268-0156. Again, 913-268-0156. And we'll repeat that number again later, too. There's also our National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that number is 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. And there's also a text, a safe text line. If you text to 741-741, you'll also be connected with somebody via text who can help intervene and help provide some support. So those would be some options, kind of a step below that imminent safety risk of somebody to reach out to with you're with your kiddo and want some help or to call somebody or to give that number to somebody that you care about, those numbers.
I just want to tag team to that you might not always know, is this imminent or not? Which do I call? And so just call one or the other, and it's okay. If you call 911 and it turns out it's not as an emergent issue as you might think, that'll be okay, and they'll let you know what other options are available. If you call our crisis line and we're talking with you and we think this is really, like, we need to act on this right now in that situation, you know, we'll talk you through it and we'll give you some options and help you consider what other things are happening. Maybe talk to that person directly if we can. So there's a lot of different options, and you don't always have to know what the answer is. Don't have to feel like you are have that full range of skills that we're talking about today. But just know, like, I'm gonna make that phone call, or I'm gonna ask some of those questions.
I appreciate that, and this might date myself, and I'm all right with that. So really, truly, the question is, who are you gonna call, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Is in any scenario, you can really ask yourself, who are you going to call? And like there are answers. And there is 911 in certain scenarios. There is a local crisis line. There is a national crisis line. My whole shtick, if you will, is there's an answer at the end of that question. There is always someone to call at the end of that. Or, right, replace call with, engage with, talk to, intersect
text.
With, text. Yes, social media, I mean, we got into that last week a lot. We get that. I'm going to bring it back maybe a little higher level and just say, is there anything else in the community you guys want to mention that's noteworthy here?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we've talked about mental health professionals, specifically law enforcement, but you might not remember 2 weeks from now what that number was or who I need to call. So as Renee said, I think there's always someone around who can at least guide you to the next step. That can be, you know, another person in your life that's a care provider. That could be a doctor. It could be a nurse. It could be a school professional. Maybe the teacher. Maybe a school counselor. Maybe it's the principal. Maybe it's the school resource officer. Maybe you decide, I'm going to call my insurance company because I know I need to do something to get some help, but I'm not sure what that resource is. Maybe it's my employee assistance program at my work. Maybe I'm aware of a support group at my church or in the community. And so there's lots of different things happening. Shanna mentioned the coalition. There's websites out there. So there's always something that you can at least start with for that next step. It might not be the only answer or the best answer, but just taking that next step is super important.
I also did not mention earlier, we in terms of our relationship with our law enforcement community, we have a mental health co-responder program that hopefully many folks in Johnson County have heard about or some awareness of that program. And the mental health co-responder is a licensed mental health clinician that is embedded with our local police departments. And at this point, the program has expanded to where we have a co-responder that's attached and affiliated with most all Johnson County law enforcement agencies. And the role of the co-responder when they're on duty is to be a first responder. So they are housed and office at the local police departments, have police radios, have access to the law enforcement dispatch and record management systems. And when law enforcement is out on a behavioral health related call and the co-responder is on duty, the co-responder will get involved and help intervene and hopefully lead to a better, more helpful outcome for all involved.
we've thrown out some kudos and talked about different, you know, law enforcement for sure. But since we're talking about youth suicide, I just want to take a moment to give kudos to our schools, our local schools, school districts, school buildings. The past few years, we've seen a significant shift in how much people are in the school system addressing behavioral health. So not only, you know, at every level, whether it's elementary school, middle school, high school, there's evidence-based programs in schools, and then training. So training for teachers, training for social workers. In 2016, here in Kansas, we passed the Jason Flatt Act. So that really made every single school district provide suicide awareness and prevention training for all school personnel. Not that they weren't doing that before, but just a universal opportunity to do that. And just emphasizing all school personnel, because although the social worker might have the training, the social worker or the counselor is not always the person in the building that the kid is going to go to. So I think that is a wonderful thing that schools are investing in that training. They're also investing in staff. So, you know, getting more social workers or training up staff that are already there. And then the other thing I've just been blown away at is all the different parent groups that are rallying behind this and hosting evening programs, and parents are coming. Parents are talking about it. Parents are disclosing their own information about mental health concerns in their family or risk of suicide or history of suicide in their family. So again, kind of going back to the schools of whether it's programming in the schools, training, boosting up professionals or parent education, they're doing a lot for this, and just really appreciate that collaboration and partnership.
I think it is safe to say, as we sit here on a community radio station and a community radio show, and how privileged we are to get this space and this time, we've got a pretty awesome community that is invested in this. I know that this is not perfect, that engaging with all of these things that we have said is perfect. And so I think we would be remiss in not putting some barriers. What are some barriers that we find our community or those who are in the moment of help, they're gonna come and maybe hit a brick wall?
Well, the first thing that I think of is just stigma. So there's the stigma of mental health issues in general, and that stigma of getting help. And so, you know, that's a really hard thing. I think that we're in a better place as a society in some respects. We're talking about it here on the radio, and that's a good thing. We talk about it more in social media. So, you know, yay for social media once in a while. I don't say that very often, but I think there are some good things we can educate in a positive way. But that stigma, that fear that people have, is pretty powerful. And just thinking about what courage it takes for people to walk through that door or make the phone call. So as much as you can support that. For me, I think language really matters. I think about that whole phrase, saying that I used to hear as a kid, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, baloney. That's so not true. Words do make a really big difference. So when we think about words related to mental health, you kind of picture in your mind that big circle with a line through it, and you think about, you know, don't using the word crazy, using the word committed suicide, and we've, a couple of us have said that here, it kind of pops out, but trying to shift that language to, you know, died by suicide or something that, you know, it doesn't reflect criminal behavior like you hear when you hear the word committed. And so supporting people when they say, I need help, or I'm going to see a therapist, or some of those kinds of things, just, you know, speaking kindly about that, not jabbing at them, not making fun of them, but providing that support and even positive, good for you for taking, you know, I'm proud of you, I encourage you, how can I help you in that area?
I'm going to go ahead and jump in and take a turn at answering my own question. What are some barriers? So specifically in my role at the Mental Health Center in the emergency services division, we do intakes. We say, hey, come on in our front door. Just sit and talk with us for a little while. Money. Guys, money is huge. Services, things cost money. And so, right, we have a lot of conversations about how can we find affordable resources for you? If it's not here, where in our community? That's a really hard question. And sometimes me and my amazing staff don't have the answer to that. So I think, stigma. Susan, hit the nail on the head there, number one. I think money comes in top of the list as well. Any other barriers? Am I right, Mom?
Yeah, I think piggybacking on the money side, I think we can talk about money at a more micro level within the family, but also taking a look at our the big picture and how as a society we're spending our resources and looking at the state of Kansas in particular. I would encourage folks out there to just be cognizant of how much money we are spending on and investing as a state into suicide prevention and mental health treatment for everybody, or oftentimes, unfortunately, not spending as has been the last 10 years. And Kansas is not a Medicaid expansion state. That also creates a barrier for a lot of families in being able to easily access services.
I wish that hours flew by this quickly. In my 9-to-5, my boss is sitting here with me.
Boss is here.
Man, sometimes I don't think
mine is
first,
too.
Which I advised everyone to do last week. And so, to wrap us up, I want to ask the same thing that I did to our panel last week. If there's one thing that you want someone to take away from our time tonight or over these last two segments that we've had, here's your chance. Share something to be remembered.
I think what I would throw out there, particularly with kiddos, is building a relationship with your kids. I think in was at a training a couple weeks ago, and we were all introducing ourselves and went through a bit of an icebreaker about a fond memory as a childhood, and it was sort of interesting. Most of us were in our mid-30s on up in that training, I would estimate. And we all sort of talked about the notion of a free-range childhood, of being outside and connecting with friends and playing with our friends and going camping with our family and spending time having family dinners together and stuff. And I don't want to sit and idealize the past too much, but I think that there's a thread of that maybe is missing. And so I would encourage and ask parents, loved ones, caregivers, guardians to be deliberate on a weekly basis of trying to carve out an hour of spending some mindful one-on-one time that doesn't involve technology with your kiddos and building relationships.
You took mine, Rob. That's really the same thing that comes to mind is just finding the way to connect. And we, as parents, as as just anyone in our world, we're such a busy, busy society. We have a lot of pressures about do, and more. And just taking those, even if it's not 1 hour at one segment, it's 5 minutes at night before bedtime. It's a car ride. It's taking your kid home from practice. Whatever it can be for you, just spending those few minutes here and there or segments of time to make that connection and make sure they know that you're listening to them. Put your phone down. We've all been there, right? When our kid calls us out, maybe on, Mom, you're telling me you do it too. So I think that's just really important to take the time to listen. And I'll just add in one more thing that I think we've talked about a lot, but is really key, and that's just ask the question. Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Are you thinking about killing yourself? And ask that question.
And for me, it's just, have the courage to say something, to do something, to reach out, to show that you care, trust your gut, you know, whether that's whatever concern that is, and just reaching out to someone saying, I care about you. I've noticed things are different. It doesn't have to be perfect what you say. Listen, care about them, and let them know that you're willing to help them and stay with them and find that support that they need.
I just want to add one more piece as we're wrapping up, that probably there could be some folks listening here who have experienced a suicide by a family member or a friend. And what about you who are left behind, the survivors? There certainly are resources out there specific to you, and a lot of good ways that can help. There's support groups out there. There's individual counseling. Though I don't have all those things sitting in front of me, If you go to the Johnson County website and you can just Google Johnson County Mental Health, you'll find some resources there. And again, you can use those same numbers yourself to call us and ask us for more specific resources. But we know it's hurtful for you too, for those of you who have experienced this in your life, and many, many of us have. So again, we want you to feel that you're taken care of as well.
I appreciate ending on that, Susan. It really does hit home that we are a community. We are a community of those who are struggling with this right now, have, maybe will. And so I really appreciated that. I do want to reiterate those phone numbers if I can as we end our segment tonight. Johnson County Mental Health Crisis Line, 913-268-0156. The National Suicide Prevention Line, 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. And there is the texting option, 741-741. If you text that number, someone will respond to that text message. This has been amazing. This has been a wonderful, wonderful time to talk with colleagues in a really special way. Thank you, Kansas City community. Thank you, KKFI, for allowing us this space.
And thanks to our guests tonight on the Thursday night special with information about teen suicide. And both last week and this week's programs will be available on podcast. Last week's is already up on our website, kkfi.org. And this week's will be up sometime tomorrow. You're tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the local showcase.